This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
Welcome to the Migration Podcast, your guide for waterfowl hunting tactics, gear, and conservation. And now, your host, Brian Halbly.
What is up, everyone? As John A.M. said, I'm your host, Brian Halbly. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to tune in to the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. Thank you so much. This episode is brought to you by Bluebird Waterfowl, creator of The Animator. The Animator is revolutionizing the waterfowl community with the world's first spinning wing decoy conversion kit. Turn your existing spinner into a water motion decoy in seconds and learn how to finish more birds with the sound of water. Guaranteed to boost your hunt or your money back. Flaring birds with your spinner is a thing of the past. Try one risk-free at bluebirdwaterfowl.com or at your favorite local outdoor supplier. This episode is also brought to you by the Duck Hole & Company, attracting feathers together. They are a full-service habitat company located in North Carolina. If you have questions about waterfowl habitat or need some work done on your property, contact them directly through any of their social media platforms at the Duck Hole Company. They can also fix you up with golden millet, also known as the duck buffet, and the best bang for your duck. This episode is also brought to you by CK Custom Calls, custom built in the USA from the great state of Texas. Handmade in a world of mass produced. Check out their calls on their Instagram and Facebook pages at CK Custom Calls. They showcase calls for sale there, and you can also contact them for a custom order. I appreciate all the support you all have been showing to our partners. I know George from Bluebird Waterfowl is out on the show circuit right now going around the country, and he's had some of our listeners pick up the animator at his booths. Brett Travis from Louisiana commented on our Instagram. I called Caden from CK Custom Calls before I even finished the podcast and ordered a call. Appreciate that, Brett. And John at the Duck Hole and Company has been busy filling orders as always. In fact, I understand my shipment of golden millet will be here soon. I'm looking forward to planning it on some of my private and permission pieces. So thanks again, everybody. When you contact any of our partners, just be sure to let them know you heard them here on the Migration Waterfowl Podcast, and they'll get you fixed up. Super great guys to deal with, and quality services and products. I had a nice overnight getaway with some friends on Friday night. We went up to a place called Nemacolin Woodlands Resort. It's in the place called the Laurel Highlands of Pennsylvania. I guess you'd call that a bigger part of the Allegheny Mountains or the Appalachian Mountains. Pretty cool place. It's been there quite a while. It's really changed a lot over the last handful of years. When my wife and I first started going there, she actually won a weekend trip up there. That's how we ended up there the very first time. And then we discovered after that free weekend that we won that they had a military discount package for any veterans or active military. And the rooms were pretty reasonable back then. I think they were less than $200. And, you know, it was like under $100 a night to get a room there. So we enjoyed going there. They had several pools and a zoo and golf courses, zip lining. Trying to think what else. It's a pretty unique mountain resort, kind of in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. Kind of a hidden gem, but they got really popular a couple of years back. They were featured on the show called, I think it's called The Bachelor or Bachelorette. Apologies if I'm screwing that up, but I'm not really up on those type of shows. But from what I've read and heard about, it really blew up with current pop culture and celebrities and things started coming there, and it just got crazy. So haven't been up there as much since that all occurred a few years back. We actually used to have different work conferences and work training up there before it got ridiculously overpriced. But a real good friend of mine that I went there with this past Friday, I've known him, geez, I think he was probably 14 or 15 when I started working out here in this small town, and came from a good family, got to know him and his family pretty well. And he was always a hustler from the time I met him, even at 15 and then 16 when he got his driver's license, he was scrapping metal and just always cutting grass, working a couple of different jobs, and just one of those type of people that you knew was going to be successful because they were such a hard worker. And he turned his skills of working for a landscaping company and being an arborist, tree cutting, he turned that into his own business, started small, cutting grass, cutting trees down. And next thing you know, it grew into this tri-state area. You know, we're pretty close to the borders of West Virginia and Ohio. Really successful company, started getting contracts for different state projects for cutting grass and trimming trees along state highways and state roads, and just started blowing up from there. And the kind of a funny thing was he actually wanted to get into law enforcement while he was kind of doing all these odd jobs before he started his own business. And, you know, still a lot of honor and dignity in serving your community and taking the role of law enforcement. But in this day and age, it's really difficult for me to push anybody into that career field, especially after almost 30 years of me being in law enforcement. I'm thankful that we still have people that want to do it. We all should be. It's a tough job these days. Completely different than the job that I took 30 years ago. I'm not going to go too far down that rabbit hole. But anyway, he decided to pursue his business and kind of let the law enforcement, option go by the wayside. And turned it into a very successful company. So he ended up becoming a member. He was doing a lot of business up at this resort with different clients and ended up buying a house up there that's just next to the resort property. So, and he's a member there, the country club and all that good stuff. So he was kind enough to invite me and a bunch of our friends. They actually spent the whole weekend golfing and hanging out at the pool bar and all that stuff. But I was able to just get up for Friday afternoon. And I spent the night, hung out at the pool, had the live band, had a good dinner. Got the fellowship with some good guys that I don't get to spend enough time with. So, but it's pretty cool if you ever get through this way. It's a little town called Farmington, PA, where the resort is in the Lower Highlands. It's worth stopping and checking out. And like I said, it's a little bit pricey nowadays if you want to go in and spend the night. But they do have a ton of activities and a ton of stuff going on. But yeah, I was just real appreciative of my buddy to do that. The cool thing about him, he's one of those super down-to-earth guys that never forgot where he came from or his small town roots. And I love to see hardworking good people be successful like that. So that kind of took up most of my Friday and half of Saturday. My oldest daughter, Allie, came home from medical school just about the time I got home on Saturday, which was a nice surprise. It's been a few weeks since I saw her. So that was great to catch up with her, spend some time together. She's back at it, of course, this week. Really interesting, the stuff that she's learning and getting into right off the bat. Pretty excited for her and looking forward to this new journey that she's taken on, and excited to see where the Lord's going to take her with this gift. Later this week, I'll be moving my youngest daughter, Elena, into her college apartment. She stayed in the dorms her freshman year last year. So she's got some friends she's going to get an apartment with. That worked out really well with my oldest daughter. That you guys that have kids of college age knows what that's like, moving kids in and out and storing all their stuff in between semesters and summertime. And it's kind of nice just to have an apartment that they can just keep all their stuff in and not have to be moved in and out for a couple of years. Just makes things a lot easier. But she's been accumulating free furniture and all kind of other items all summer. So my garage and several rooms in the house are full of all kind of stuff. I'm definitely going to miss her when she goes back. It's been a lot of fun having her home this summer. But I'm not going to miss all the stuff that's prevented my annual garage and house purging and organizing. Really restocked a lot of the waterfowl stuff and replaced a lot of the waterfowl stuff that needed updated, and didn't have a chance to really get all that organized. So I've been kind of doing that in small steps the last couple of weeks while my truck's in the shop getting the transmission taken care of. But, yeah, things are changing quick. My wife, Karen, goes back to teaching school in about 2 weeks. So things are going to be completely different around here. in the next couple of weeks. A lot of my free time will be becoming my time once again as I start to transition into my late summer and fall routine as we approach the hunting season. I mentioned the truck. They're still working on it. I know they had a couple of jobs before mine, so I gave the guy a deposit last week, and he said he had the parts on order. So hopefully that'll get wrapped up soon. Looking forward to getting that back so I can ramp up my scouting and start taking care of some things and other preparations as we get closer to hunting season. I mentioned I've got a deer lease in Ohio a couple of times. Got a few projects down there. I'm not panicking yet, but this is time to start getting trail cameras back out, getting feeders set up. We've got a few cameras out. My one lease partner has a couple of cameras that he runs year-round. So we've got some inventory going. We've got some really nice bucks showing up. But got some projects and some just, you know, standard preparation stuff. Checking tree stand straps, checking blinds. And then we've got a fall planting work weekend coming up to plant our fall food plots. The summer food plots did real well. Company, my one lease partner owns a company called Vitalize Seed. It's a really innovative seed company, and all of our food plots have done super well. If you're in the market for any type of food plot seed, if you're into deer hunting or turkey hunting, anything like that, it's beyond just the normal co-op stuff that a lot of companies just throw a mix in a bag and slap a price tag on it. He's actually done a lot of research with varieties of plants that'll rebuild the soil as well as feed the deer. So you're not just, you know, feeding deer and turkey and stripping the soil of all their nutrients. You're actually putting a lot more back into it. But I don't want to get too technical because he's the guru on that. Just go to vitalizeseed.com. That'll answer all your questions or give him a call. But it's a really special product that he has going on there. So, but that's going to be about it for what I've got going on around here. Just super excited as the calendar keeps ticking towards early teal season. I've got a great episode coming up in a couple of weeks from a guy that I got to know from Ohio who's been pretty successful on teal over there. So I've been e-scouting a bunch of spots over there across the border and just getting excited to get closer to that. And also my trip out west to hunt teal in Kansas and Nebraska. So just plugging away, trying to keep this content coming to you guys and gals. I'm really enjoying it. Trying to keep the YouTube channel updated and the social media updated. Got a few pieces of feedback here and there. I really appreciate all of you who take time to do that. The reviews keep popping up on Apple Podcasts. I think Spotify's got a few now. Everyone's been saying some really nice things. I appreciate it. But I also want to hear, you know, maybe some stuff that you don't like, or something you'd like to see me change. So, any constructive criticism is welcome. I want to, keep improving this and making this platform better for all of you listeners out there. So yeah, just, keep sending me notes, keep sending me reviews, and I'm just going to keep working hard to continue to bring you some interesting content. And be sure to check out Migration Mondays on our YouTube channel. Those episodes are our video companion to this audio podcast. This week I share a video clip from our audio episode with George from Bluebird Waterfowl. about the Animator spinning wing decoy conversion kit and how to use it. He sent me a bunch of animators. I'm looking forward to putting them in the service coming up here soon. So I'll be keeping you posted on my experiences with them and our overall hunting experiences. And while you're over there at the YouTube channel, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the latest uploads. As I mentioned before, I'll be recording all of my scouting and hunting this summer and fall and posting those videos to the YouTube channel. One of the best things you can do to help support the show is to tell your waterfowl hunting family and friends about the Migration Waterfowl podcast. Word of mouth is super important to shows like mine. The more we can get the word out, the more people listen. That brings more support from partners and more listeners and just overall sharing of the product to help reach more people. So those couple of things you can do don't cost you any money. It helps me out a lot. That includes leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you could take a minute to leave a 5-star review there, then send me a message and I'll get you a Migration Waterfowl podcast decal in the mail. And I think that's going to be everything that I have for you today. I'm really looking forward to getting into this episode. I'm going to be talking with Thomas Hoke. He's the owner and host of Hoke Outdoors. Thomas was introduced to the outdoors by his father while growing up in Virginia. We discuss his transformation from deer and turkey hunter to becoming obsessed with waterfowl. We talk about the diversity of waterfowl hunting across Virginia, the challenges of hunting the Atlantic Flyway, and some tactics for scouting and hunting the region. We get into what prompted him to leave Virginia and start hunting out of state, ending up as far away as Alaska. We also discuss some hunt filming, hunting equipment, dog training, and a few stories. I really enjoyed talking with Thomas and getting to know him a little bit better. So let's get into episode number 14. Welcome back to another episode of the Migration Waterfowl Podcast. Got a special guest tonight, Mr. Thomas Hoke from Virginia. How you doing tonight, Thomas?
Oh, doing pretty good. Doing pretty good. Just trying to stay cool up here in Minnesota right now, which feels funny to say. I'm sure all my friends back home in Virginia would be calling me a sissy for calling 85 degrees warm. But after the weather we've had up here this spring, 85 degrees and a little bit of humidity is kicking my butt. So definitely not acclimated to the southern heat like I used to be.
So you're up there building some duck calls, I think?
Yep. Yeah. So I work up here for DRC Calls, work for Corey Loeffler, and going on my fourth year up here now, which feels crazy to say, but yeah, loving every second of it. We make duck, goose, and crane calls, and direct-to-consumer, all made right here in Minnesota, so all-American made, and really proud to be a part of this company.
That's very cool. How much time do you spend up there in the off-season?
I'm up here basically full time now, you know, as full time as a family owned call shop can be. You know, it's Corey owns the business. He's run it for the past almost 20 years now. And it's really just him, his wife, and then, you know, a couple local guys here and there. But, you know, I'm up here probably 9 months of the year, pretty much April, May through December, January.
Very cool. Well, before we get too far down the road, if you could take a minute, let our listeners know who you are, where you're from, and what you do for work, anything like that.
Yeah, for sure, 100%. Yeah, my name's Thomas Hoke. I'm originally from Virginia. Now I reside in Minnesota, but I'm the creator of the Hoke Outdoors YouTube channel. Started out my senior year of high school as the Virginia Outdoors Unlimited YouTube channel, and been creating videos over there on YouTube for, gosh, past 7-8 years now. And then I've been working up here for Corey at DRC Calls for the past 4 years. So that's basically my life in a nutshell. I'm obsessed with waterfowl hunting. I try to surround my life with as much waterfowl hunting and waterfowl hunting centric stuff as possible. And I've been blessed to be able to do that really for the last couple years.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing to go right from high school to running around and running the YouTube channel and then helping out building duck calls. Did you have any jobs in between the two?
Yeah, actually, I went to college for 4 years. I'm out of high school. I got an environmental science degree, and going into college, I thought I wanted to be a waterfowl biologist. And then after 4 years of college, and COVID came right in the middle of my time in college, watching college change from COVID. By the end of it, I was burnt out on school. I did not want to go and do 2 to 4 more years for a master's and PhD. And so started looking at other options, and I was lucky enough to be blessed with the opportunity to start working for Corey right around the time that I was starting to wrap up college, and just worked out perfectly where I was able to kind of transition right into that when I finished up school.
Very cool. Did you start waterfowl hunting with some family members, or kind of how did you get into it in Virginia?
So I grew up deer and turkey hunting, a little bit of dove hunting, a little bit of goose hunting here, all with my dad. My dad's always been a huge outdoorsman. Fishing is really his main passion, but he's always done a ton of hunting, really a lot of deer hunting and turkey hunting. And so he had me out in the woods from my earliest memories. Growing up, I used to always tell people my favorite day was Dove Day, which was opening day of dove season for us. We'd go out and go on kind of a group dove hunt with a lot of family friends. And it was just a really special day to me. You know, my dad, like I said, we did more deer and turkey hunting. But for some reason, the birds have always captivated me. Doves, just the hunting them, having them in my hands, just everything about a dove was always extremely captivating to me from a young age. And so we dabbled into waterfowl hunting a little bit, mainly goose hunting. But from those earliest experiences, I was always had a real desire to try to get more into waterfowl hunting. And so right about the time I got my driver's license and started to get a little more freedom, I really got into waterfowl hunting my junior year of high school. And then I'd say by my senior year of high school, I was fully hooked. But still love deer turkey hunting. And really, I credit my dad for kind of my drive to explore public lands, because growing our deer hunting, we did a little bit on private land, a little bit on public land. But when we would hunt public land, we would always go way back into places. So really, we were hunting in the Blue Ridge Mountains. So we would go way up the mountain, pretty close to the top most of the time, just to get away from all the other pressure. And so that's kind of translated into my waterfowl hunting as well.
Yeah, that's pretty rugged country for nobody familiar with Blue Ridge Mountains. For the East Coast, it's pretty rugged.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I remember getting into some pretty sketchy situations, I would say, with my dad. You know, nothing too crazy, but he certainly wasn't afraid to drag me into some deep wilderness, which I'm really appreciative of now. You know, at the time, I think it kind of soured me to deer hunting just a little bit, because it was like we were putting in all this work to not even see a deer a lot of times, or only see a couple does. But now it has really translated into waterfowl hunting for me.
So I'm guessing you needed that driver's license to get to some better waterfowl hunting spots if you were used to hunting the mountains there.
Yeah. We kind of lived in between the mountains and the beach, pretty much central Virginia growing up. And so we'd just travel to go hunt in the Blue Ridge for deer. My dad had some family friends up there that we could stay with and hunt with and things like that. But it really helped me, I'd say, explore more getting that driver's license. I actually bought a kayak before I ever had my driver's license. I knew I was getting it soon. And I found this 12-foot kayak on Craigslist for like $250, $300. made my mom drive over there with me with my dad's truck, and we went and bought it. And then a couple months later, I got my driver's license. And luckily, Virginia, you know, Virginia doesn't have an incredible amount of public land, but it certainly has enough for a 16-year-old to get his toes wet. So I was driving all over the place with that kayak, launching it anywhere I could get it in the water, and just trying to find a few ducks.
Yeah. So kind of walk us through, what's that look like if you're starting out in Virginia? Are you kind of hunting some marshes or coastal waters, or what are you keying in on there?
Really, I think probably the coolest thing about Virginia, I wouldn't say Virginia is an incredible waterfowl hunting state by any stretch of the imagination. For most people, I'd say it probably ranges somewhere from good to bad in terms of how they would interpret the waterfowl hunting there. But Virginia has a ton of diversity, you know, like you can go 2 hours west to the Blue Ridge Mountains and go try and chase geese in fields out there, and maybe even some field ducks out there, and shoot ducks on really small streams and some really beautiful places with mountains as the backdrop. And then you can also from there go, you know, back all the way to the coast and hunt salt marshes and some really historic places on the eastern shore of Virginia, in the Chesapeake Bay. And then you have everywhere in between there, which is mainly swamps. You got some lakes, you got some rivers. You know, there's really a ton of different areas you can get into. And I think that's probably the coolest thing about Virginia. You know, you can go shoot sea ducks on the coast, and then in the morning, and then in the afternoon, you can be shooting big Canadas in a cornfield in the Shenandoah Valley.
Hmm. Very cool. So what, kind of walk us through the first couple of hunts. Maybe you were by yourself and you started to be more successful and figuring out where were you hunting and what kind of species were you able to harvest?
For me, it was really, really wood ducks that I cut my teeth on those first couple years. For some reason, I've always been fascinated with swamps. I've always been fascinated with water. I think that's probably a commonality between most of us waterfowlers, is that water is really, when you're driving around, when I'm driving around somewhere, I'm looking at every pond and swamp on the side of the road, but swamps were always what drew my attention. And having that kayak, it allowed me to get back into swamps that were inaccessible by other means of transportation. You know, there's a lot of guys in Virginia that have mud motors and they'll run the rivers and the marshes and stuff like that, and they can get to most of the good holes on those with a mud motor and a John boat. And then there's guys that walk in, but I found kind of a middle ground there with my kayak where I was able to access these shallow swamps that were really too mucky to walk into, but too shallow to get a mud motor into, and was able to have some decent success with wood ducks my first year, and then kind of started to figure out mallards a little bit more my second year. But you know, Virginia's tough. There's no way of, you know, I wouldn't say it any other way than that. You know, Virginia hunting, it can be really tough at times. I was super lucky my senior year. Actually, we got what might be the best cold front of my entire life in Virginia. We were south or north of the ice line for close to 2 weeks. Everything was locked up. There was a lot of birds around, and so I was really lucky to get on some really good hunting my senior year of school. And then those 4 years I was in college was some tough hunting stretches, just trying to figure it out on Virginia public land. But I wouldn't have it any other way. I feel like it really made me a better waterfowl hunter to try to cut my teeth in one of the certainly I'd say the toughest flyway in the country.
Yeah, I agree with that. No, I'm in the Atlantic Flyway, but just a few minutes from the Ohio line, which turns into the Mississippi. So I'm kind of in no man's land here, but I can appreciate the toughness of the Atlantic Flyway for sure.
Yeah, no doubt at all. Yeah, that's being right on that transition line is tough. I have some friends who went to school in Western Virginia or West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and being right there in kind of the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains, it can be very daunting for chasing ducks because you really don't have much. I don't want to speak for Pennsylvania, but I know Virginia, once you get out into the mountains there, you have hardly anything public for waterfowl hunting. And so it really turns into knocking on doors and trying to get a landowner to let you hunt his pond or something like that.
Yeah, for sure. So when you started killing more mallards, was there something that you could put your finger on that you were switching up, maybe tactics or areas that help you kind of graduate from just wood ducks to mallards?
I'd say probably areas. I'd say I was probably starting to figure out more of what the ducks were feeding on. You know, that first year I was into it, I was just looking for ducks. I didn't really know why the ducks were anywhere in particular. I just knew, hey, there's wood ducks in the swamp most every time I go and hunt it. I should just keep hunting it until I don't, you know, find any wood ducks in there anymore, which is certainly a mistake. You know, I was over hunting a lot of places, I would say. But then that next year, I got over that summer, I spent a lot of time doing off-season scouting and figuring out where the food sources were. And so I wasn't just hunting kind of transitional areas, I would say. You know, a lot of that first year, a lot of my hunting was just wood duck pass shooting, just setting up in a good area of the swamp where I knew the wood ducks were coming through and pass shooting them that way. But then that next year, I was able to say, oh, there was a lot of smartweed growing here during the summer. I'm going to go back in there and scout. And I was finding a lot more mallards, focusing in on things like smartweed, arum, things like that, duckweed. So really, I'd say it's probably figuring out the food sources was the biggest change between that first and second season.
Yeah, that's super important. I'm glad you went into the species too. I'm always interested in what guys are keying in on different parts of the country.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's probably one of the tougher things about the Atlantic Flyway is that unless you're right there on the coast, it seems like the majority of your bag along most of the flyway is going to be predominantly wood ducks with some mallards, black ducks, maybe a couple teal in there. But we just don't get the diversity that you get across a lot of the country.
Yeah. Well, you certainly carved out a niche there in Virginia. I know on your YouTube channel, you always are able to post some successful hunts and you got quite a few of them on there. So that's probably just, from years of experience and putting together a body of work where you kind of know where to waste your time now.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of perseverance, a lot of trial and error. At times, I'd say a lot more error than success, but just pushing through that. And like you said, just kind of figuring out what areas were good, what areas aren't. It's a lot easier to burn a tank of gas in Virginia scouting than you would think. Definitely put my miles on, and you know, to this day, I wouldn't say I have Virginia duck hunting figured out. It's just like duck hunting anywhere. It's always a changing environment, changing landscape, and so you kind of have to hone back in every year. And it's been actually tougher for me to hunt Virginia the last couple of years because I'm not there during the summer, during the early fall, to really see the habitat conditions. You know, the last couple of years, I've basically just been going back for Christmas. And so I just show up and I'm kind of starting at a blank slate. And that's made it considerably tougher, I would say, to find ducks in my old stomping grounds.
Yeah, for sure. So kind of walk us through what made you decide to start heading out of state and what that kind of looked like. When did you start doing that?
I think during college, I would take some 4As into North Carolina. There was times during the season where North Carolina was open, but Virginia was closed. So I would jump the border there and go down into North Carolina and most of the time get my teeth kicked in down there. You know, I thought there was a lot of hunters on Virginia public land, but then you go down to North Carolina public land and, oh, trying to get away from the crowd on North Carolina public land. If you can do that consistently, I think you're probably one of the better waterfowl hunters in the entire country if you can find ducks in a secluded spot on North Carolina public land. But I think the first trip I took was the first Flyways Collective. I went out to Kansas with some other YouTubers and we kind of did a little group hunt for a few days. And after that, I knew I wanted to get back out there, but being in college, I had the college budget. I just wasn't able to really go and take any trips at the time. So when I came up here to Minnesota for that first year was really when I'd say I started to branch out into hunting other states more. And then I've just kind of, that snowballed, I would say, the past few years to where now I'm predominantly hunting, anywhere except Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely want to get into that, but kind of walk us through when you decided to go to North Carolina, what did that look like? Were you doing a lot of e-scouting beforehand or trying to talk to some people that you might have known down in the area?
Oh, definitely a little bit of both. You know, I had some really good contacts down there, and when I started, the first couple trips I took down there, I would say the contacts who I had, they were doing most of the legwork, and I was kind of just jumping in the boat and piggybacking off of them. And then from there, you know, I did do a lot of e-scouting. Among my friend circle, I would say most people would characterize me as like OCD when it comes to Onyx. I mean, my Onyx is crazy. The amount of pins I drop on places that I will probably never set eyes on, it can be a little bit overboard at times. So I was dropping a lot of pins, and when I was able to get down there, burning a lot of gas and just putting on a lot of miles. I mean, that's the only way to, I'd say, to get familiar with an area like that, somewhere that you haven't grown up, somewhere that's brand new to you. You just got to spend your time on the maps and then spend your time on foot looking at places, seeing what the habitat looks like. And one thing I would say, I'd say the thing that brought me success more than anything in North Carolina was kind of like I said earlier, getting away from the crowd, just because they're the popular spots there are so popular that being able to find those little holes that other people had overlooked away from the crowds, I would say that's where we had our most success in terms of getting on birds.
Yeah, I'm starting to pick up a theme here. Back in Virginia, you were finding those spots that were kind of in between mud motors and walk-ins and getting away from the crowds there, and now in North Carolina. So super interesting tactic, and something that our listeners should pay attention to if they're trying to go somewhere new or trying to change up their tactics.
Yeah, for sure. And I'd say, you know, I don't want to set a general rule of thumb, but as a general rule of thumb, you know, spots that are over a mile walk, certainly over a mile and a half walk, that's going to keep most of the crowd away. You know, that was always what I was looking for on Onyx when I was e-scouting. If a spot was 2 miles from the parking area, I felt pretty confident that I would be the only one in there. But that's not always the case. Certainly, it stings a lot to walk in the dark 2 miles, and when you get to your spot, there's a headlamp already there. That one stings a lot. So it's not for the faint of heart, but when it does work out, it certainly seemed to bring some success.
Yeah, and that's a double-edged sword with Onyx. I mean, I wouldn't trade it. I'd still take it even with the additional pressure that it's brought. But I've got to get better at using the different files for things, because my map, like you said, I open it up and I'm just like, what the heck am I doing here? I've got pins where you can barely even see the map in some places. But great tool for sure. I mean,
No doubt.
I don't know how I hunted without it.
Yeah, it kind of came around right as I was getting into waterfowl hunting, so it's always been a tool that I've used, but certainly I think they've made a lot of really good improvements to it the last couple of years, and so it's become invaluable to me, I would say. Do you have a color coding system for it yet? That's been a huge thing for me. Is getting them
loosely.
Yeah, because that first season I was dropping pins all over the places and they were all the same color, and then that off season I was like, all right, I'm going to take a day. You know, I got off work for a day. I'm going to go and color code all my stuff, so I know what's public, what's private that I have permission on, what's private that I don't have permission on. And I know that's helped me out a lot with keeping everything sorted out.
Yeah, that's a really good system. I've got, I think I've got one color for places that I haven't walked. I've got another color for places that I've walked but not hunted. And just kind of loosely things like that, but I definitely got to get better at that's a good tip. I might have to take you up on that one.
Yeah, for sure. I'd be happy to share what I got as my little system there.
Yeah, so kind of give us some tips or tricks, maybe, you know, looking back when you first started going out of state, maybe some things that you picked up along the way that kind of change your preparation or the gear that you take. Is it changed depending on where you're hunting and what species, or do you kind of just take the whole kitchen, everything in the kitchen sink with you just to be prepared?
I'm certainly a take everything in the kitchen sink type of person. I was headed down to South Dakota this past year, and I'm pretty sure everybody who passed me on the highway was slow rolling me and eyeballing me, because I had decoys piled up higher than the cab of my truck out of the back of that thing. But yeah, I'd say you know, that's a tough one. There's so many different things for different hunts that I've changed over the years, things that I bring, things that I don't bring anymore. I'd say the one thing that really comes to mind is goose decoys for duck hunting. You know, I always used to think, hey, if I'm hunting ducks, I want to throw a duck spread. That's what I want to have out there. And one thing that I've learned over the years is that ducks love, and you know, I'm not sure if it's the comfort of having geese in the spread or if it's just that the goose decoys are bigger and more visible. But I found that, especially late season, having a majority goose spread with just a couple ducks sprinkled throughout can be super effective for decoying late season ducks. I think more than anything, it's probably just that comfort level is that of, you know, the geese are typically a little more wary and they're a little bit bigger. Maybe they can pull up food off the bottom that the ducks can't get to. And so certainly late season and even early season, I like to throw a lot of goose decoys in my spread if I can.
Now, can you put a number on that? How many are you putting out and kind of walk us through the setup, what that looks like?
I mean, typically as many as I can bring in. I'd say anywhere from a dozen to two dozen is probably about the size of a goose spread that I typically run. You know, if we're talking floaters, if it's somewhere that I can drive into with a trailer, I'm not opposed to throwing a bunch of decoys. I have no problem putting out and picking up decoys. That's not something I've ever been afraid of. But yeah, for sure, with floaters on the water, I'd say a dozen to two dozen. I've started using Heyday decoys the last couple of years, and so they're super lightweight, and that's allowed me to go from, I'd say, probably about a dozen on average to now, if I'm walking in or kayaking in, I'm able to drag in about two dozen.
So are you kind of bunching them up downwind, or are you kind of scattering them amongst the duck decoys, or how are you setting that up?
Typically, I'll keep them on the upwind side just in case of geese. You know, there's, and I'm not sure how much truth there is to that, but I know from the older waterfowl hunters I've hunted with, I've always heard that I'm keeping them on the downwind side. Sorry. I've always heard that geese, you know, don't like to land over duck decoys, but ducks will land over goose decoys. And I certainly don't think ducks have any problem landing with or over goose decoys. So typically, I'll keep the geese on the downwind side and then kind of just trickle the ducks up on the upwind side just a little bit.
Yeah, that's pretty similar to what I've done too. I need to get better at taking more. I have a four slot floater that's pretty easy to carry in with the rest of my equipment, and sometimes I leave the other six behind, but I gotta get better, especially when I'm by myself, at just sucking it up and getting them in there somehow.
Yeah, no doubt. And you know, I think Texas rigs makes that a little bit easier. I used to be a big slotted bag, J-hook weight type of guy, and would, you know, I'd always bring in my slotted bags with me, and then I switched over to using Texas rigs, and then this past year, actually, my boss, Corey, he's been getting it more into big game hunting the last couple of years, and so he has a couple frame packs now, and that kind of became my walk-in setup. Was I would have a frame pack, and I'd clip off two, three dozen decoys of that frame pack, and that made walking in with decoys a whole heck of a lot easier.
Yeah. Do you find that you beat the decoys up a little more that way?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I'm not easy on my decoys at all. After a season of use, my decoys are almost always showing a good bit of wear. But, you know, I think, yeah, there's certainly a give and take to that one. But
yeah,
I think
it's a trade-off for sure.
Yeah, I think if you get high-quality decoys that'll last, I don't think you'll beat them up too much doing that.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, they're getting fairly affordable, so it sucks to have to replace a lot at once, but if you get a set every once in a while, it's not too terrible.
Yeah, no doubt.
So following along on your channel for the last couple of years, I mean, you've hunted from one end of the country to the other. I mean, how many states do you think you've covered to this point?
Oh gosh. I don't, probably only about 10 to 15. Has to be somewhere in there. Okay. Yeah, so maybe closer to 15. I've hunted pretty much most of the Central Flyway at this point. I haven't really done much in the Mississippi Flyway, and then Virginia, North Carolina. I got down to Florida for a couple days this past year. I've never hunted the Northeast, which is something I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to go up and hunt New York, go hunt Maine even. So I'm hoping to get up there, but then I'd also really like to get out to the West Coast more as well. So gotta try and somehow figure out how to do both of those.
Yeah. So you made it up to Alaska even.
Yeah. Corey got a place up in Alaska this past fall or last fall. And so I went up there to check it out, get a lay of the land, and pretty quickly fell in love with Alaska. I think most people who love the exploration factor of waterfowl hunting, I think it would be hard not to fall in love with Alaska. I mean, it lives up to the name. It's the last frontier. And so it was an absolute treat to go and get to spend a month up there to start my waterfowl season. It was really like nothing I'd ever experienced. You know, I think it's probably a completely unique experience when it comes to North American waterfowl hunting. So it was something that I really enjoyed doing, and I'm hoping to be able to get back up there this fall again.
Yeah, I've been up there twice in my life, once for a caribou hunt and another time just to fish. I've never waterfowl hunted it, but after watching your videos, definitely looks super interesting. Like you said, not experiencing it, but just watching, it's just something that looks completely different than anything I've seen before.
Yeah, I think the sky's the limit when it comes to Alaska duck hunting, too. You know, there's places where you can go and, you know, probably get a cabin and go stay up there for a week and hunt right in your backyard, basically. And then you could also, you know, and not be too far off the grid, but then also you could go do a fly-in waterfowl hunt up there and be hundreds of miles from civilization, which is something that really intrigues me. I think that's probably the coolest thing about Alaska is just the vastness of it and being able to get away from civilization. And one feeling for me that kind of reigns supreme in waterfowl hunting is feeling like I'm in a place that there hasn't been another person for a very long time. That's a feeling that really resonates with me. That's a feeling that I chase a lot, I would say. So I think that's readily available in Alaska if you're willing to put in the work. What part did you go up there to go fishing?
So a friend of mine lives in Wasilla.
Okay, yeah.
We fished the Little Susitna River for silver salmon.
Oh, nice.
And then we drove over to the Prince William Sound and took a tributary up there, set up camp. We had bears coming through camp, and it was like the Discovery Channel. There's salmon swimming between your legs, and it's just like there's nothing like it. Like you said, it's just a super unique place, and definitely got to get back. I bet it's been 10 plus years since I've been up there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Get your flight booked now and get up there in September while the ducks are around. That'd be a lot of fun. I'm not sure when I'm going up. I'm not sure when I'm going to make it up there this year, but I certainly have my fingers crossed that I'm going to be able to make it happen again.
So what were the setups that you got in on up there, and what kind of species were you guys targeting?
That was probably the most surprising thing for me about Alaska. I don't know why I went in with this conception, but I went in with a conception that it would just be these all sorts of crazy different species. You know, you never really know what you were going to shoot. But up there, species-wise, it was really five species. It was mallards, pintails, widgeon, shovelers, and green-winged teal. That was pretty much all I got into. But I also didn't do a lot of traveling. I pretty much hunted an hour from the house at the furthest. And so I was kind of always in this one area. And really what we were hunting was predominantly river deltas, you know, right where the delta is, right where the river is dumping into the ocean. You'd have some pretty big kind of salt marshes, brackish water marshes. And that's where we did the majority of our hunting. And I'd say probably the toughest thing up there was just the hide. Every single hunt, the hide was a struggle because these salt marshes are like shin to ankle tall grass, and there is no brush out there at all. And most of the time, you know, we didn't have access to a boat. So we're looking at a mile to 2 mile walks in where you didn't really want to have to strap a layout blind to your bag when you already had two dozen decoys on your back. So most of the times we were just building these really rudimentary hides. And I think the saving grace for us was that we were shooting ducks in September. So they were coming pretty much right off the nesting grounds. And I think a lot of the times we were probably the first spread they had seen since they hatched out of an egg. And so I think that was really, really why the hunting was successful at times for us. But I'm hoping this year, if I'm able to get back up there, I got some ideas for how to improve the hide. So I'm hoping I can bring those to fruition.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. What do you think you would do different the second time around?
I'm thinking maybe doing, you know, I think at the most basic level, I would just bring burlap and just lay under burlap. I actually did that a lot in Virginia my first couple years because I was hunting out of my kayak, but I didn't have a blind for my kayak. So I would just bring a big sheet of burlap and just cover myself in burlap with no brush over the top of me at all. And somehow I shot ducks like that. I still don't know how that was possible. I think I got really good at learning how to use shadows when I was doing that, because that's how I would always hide. I was trying to get in the shadows and get enough shadows to break me up where I kind of looked like a log. I didn't just look like a big old piece of burlap sticking out of the swamp. And so I'm thinking at the most basic level, trying that out, maybe get some kind of greenish colored burlap and just try to lay under burlap. Because I mean, there was times where we were literally laying in the grass with nothing on top of us, and you'd have ducks trying to land on you still. So I think burlap would help a lot. But then trying to figure out some sort of lightweight layout blind setup, trying to figure out if I can get a kayak layout blind setup there, and then maybe even try to, I've thought about maybe trying to like some sort dig in, or you know, create some sort of pit blind, because it's kind of pretty soft mud up there. So I was thinking if you put an army shovel on your pack, you might even be able to dig yourself in a little bit.
Interesting.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting to follow along if you make it back up there. Be interested to see what you put into play there.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. I just, hopefully no more bear encounters. We had a pretty close one this past year, so I would be fine if I do not see or hear or smell a brown bear while I'm up there.
Yeah, fortunately, when we were fishing, it was mostly black bears. When I was up there a second time for a caribou hunt, we had one walk by about 300 yards away on the next ridge, and that was close enough for me, too, so
yeah,
I can appreciate that.
No doubt. Yeah, I'd say 200 to 300 yards is plenty close enough. 100 yards, I'm going to start to pucker up a little bit after what we experienced last time.
So you mentioned you started your YouTube channel in high school. So have you pretty much been filming the entire time that you've really gotten hardcore into waterfowl, or did that kind of progress along with that?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think I was filming from pretty much the start of when I got into waterfowl hunting. You know, it was really rudimentary those first couple of years, really figuring out how to make a video and how to capture the action and do all that. But, you know, it's kind of been I've been able to film my entire progression through waterfowl hunting, which I'm really thankful for. I think the only downside to it would be, I think it's made me a worse storyteller. Because basically all my stories have been told through video. I record everything when I'm hunting. And so there's not a lot of times I tell a story about a hunt and there's not a video to back it up, or it's, you know, it's not, maybe the memory is distorted by what I have on video but versus what I don't. So I think it's certainly made me a worse storyteller, which I wish it didn't. But beyond that, I mean, I have years of memories saved. I hunted a lot with my dad those first couple years that I was filming, and then his health has deteriorated a little bit, so he hasn't been able to get out into the swamps quite as much. And so I really, really treasure those videos now, to be able to go back and watch those hunts from 6-7 years ago when he was able to trudge out into the swamp with me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's why the majority of us start doing it. I mean, I think the trade-off, like you said, you know, you might not remember it the same as the video shows it, but at least you have it there and you have exactly what happened. I think I would rather have it that way than, you know, we have a tendency to romanticize things when we think back and change how things actually were. So I think I'd take the trade-off to have everything on film so you can go back and sit in your rocking chair with your grandkids someday and show them everything that you experienced.
No doubt at all. Yeah. Hopefully I will not be one of those older waterfowl hunters someday who's like, it's not as good as it used to be. Hopefully I'll be able to say, you know, it's even better than it used to be and be able to show videos to back that up. I think I kind of think that's a fallacy among maybe all sorts of outdoorsmen, is that I think we always think it's not as good as it used to be. I think we, like you said, we romanticize those old memories, and there's always more birds and more fish and more everything mm-hmm. back in the day. So I think hopefully down the road in 40, 50 years, I'll still be doing it and I'll be able to look back and say for sure whether or not it was better back then.
Yeah, for sure. So you've picked up a pretty big following now all the years you've been posting to YouTube. Has that affected how you've approached filming and storytelling and how you present your content? Or are you kind of just doing what you've always done and trying to stick with what you know?
I'd say probably a little bit of both. I mean, I still kind of the basic fundamentals of what I'm doing and the reasons I'm doing it are still the same. You know, I want to have those memories. I want to be able to go back and look back on those and learn from those, the past mistakes that I've made, the past successes I've had. But you know, it certainly has changed a little bit. I think I've tried to put out a higher quality product now than I did at the start. You know, at the start I had hope that maybe someday people would watch them, but I didn't, you know, I don't think any 17-year-old really believes they're going to have much success putting a video on YouTube. You know, there's millions of videos probably being put out every year on YouTube. So as I've been able to have success with that and build a really awesome community, I've tried to make my product higher quality and make those videos more enjoyable to watch.
So on the equipment side, what are you using nowadays for your average hunt to get everything on film?
Pretty much just, I got two GoPro Hero 10s. And so typically I stick one on my head, which not my favorite thing in the world to do. You'll probably hear pretty much anybody who yeah. does that and has a YouTube channel say that. You know, I don't think anybody likes wearing a GoPro on their head for any extended period of time, but it's just one of the trade-offs. And then, typically stick one out there in the spread, and then I have a kind of a bigger video camera, Canon XF400, and so I'll use that to get some videos of retrieves, B-roll, birds flying, everything like that, and then typically just my iPhone. You know, I think you can create really immersive, great story telling videos with just an iPhone and a GoPro. And I have those two GoPros so that I can take more of a hands-off approach to filming as much as possible. You know, I never wanted the filming side of things to get in the way of hunting. Right when I got into it, I knew that, you know, I wanted to waterfowl hunt more than I wanted to make videos. If it ever came to a point where I had to decide between the two, I was going to pick waterfowl hunting every single time. And so that's always kind of been my approach to it, is finding a way to capture as much of the hunt as possible and capture as much of the experience and the story as possible while not interfering with the hunt and not making it any more difficult or any less enjoyable than it needed to be.
Yeah, that's a great approach. It's worked for you, and it's proven that that's what people want to see. They kind of want to see that rawness and you know, the realism coming from your hunt. I appreciate cinematic effects and beautiful videography and stuff as much as the next guy, but your average hunter, he wants the experience with your experience and hear a good story.
Yeah, no doubt. I think that's probably the key to YouTube more than anything, is just having a connection with your viewer. And I know when the first couple of years when I was trying to figure out how I wanted to video hunts, the videos that really resonated with me were freelance duck hunting and really the way I was able to feel like I was on the hunt with him. And I could imagine myself going on that same hunt. If it was a solo hunt, I could imagine myself being there and doing that same work that he was doing. So that was really the way I wanted to try to create my, you know, videos, was to make it immersive for people and have it be relatable, where people could put themselves in my shoes and learn from what I was doing, or, you know, take what I was doing as a thing not to do.
Yeah, Elliot does a great job over there for sure. And I think he's going into season 10. So that speaks volumes of his success and how well he does it there for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. I owe a lot of my passion, I would say, for waterfowl hunting for him, you know, really those first couple years. Or, you know, he was a mentor for me, really probably more than anything. You know, I was I think probably one of the unique things about how I got into waterfowl hunting was that I was solo hunting a lot my first year. I did not have a, you know, my dad really didn't want to come with me on the kayak. You know, he would walk into a few swamps with me, but on those kayak hunts, I was almost always alone. And so I was watching Elliot's videos and trying to learn about shot selection and where to be and how to work birds and all of the things.
Yeah, getting back to the equipment side of it, mentioned the iPhone. I use a Mac to edit all my stuff, and on my iPhone, I could just hit that AirDrop and puts that footage right on there. And it's easy to get lazy and just keep using that thing. But like you said, thankfully, there's such a good camera on there. It does a fairly decent job of that. So,
yeah, actually, my old iPhone, it seems like those iPhones, like you said, I mean, Apple, I think they have a great system in terms of video editing. Like, there's nothing that beats the combination of an iPhone and Mac. I mean, you can your workflow with that setup is going to be, I think it's going to beat anything else 9 times out of 10. But it seems like, at least for me, with the amount of times I drop them in the water and everything like that, it seems like those iPhones have about a 3 to 4 year lifespan. So I had to get another one this summer, and every time I get one, I'm just blown away with the camera. And my big camcorder is starting to crap out a little bit. So I'm starting to, you know, going into season now, I'm trying to make the decision on whether I need to buy a new one or if I can just roll with the iPhone camera from here on out.
Yeah. So what do you think the craziest thing that's ever happened to you while waterfowl hunting, or maybe something crazy you saw, or maybe a favorite hunting story that you could tell us?
Oh, man, probably I say the craziest thing, and I've told this story a lot of times, so I'll keep it kind of short, but I got hit in the head by a goose my freshman year of college. We were hunting a little island on a lake and having just an incredible hunt. I mean, maybe my best ever Virginia waterfowl hunt. Just birds showed up overnight and they were everywhere, but we had a flock of passing geese come over at about 35, 40 yards, and I rolled one up and went to shoot a second one and knocked a second one down. And right as I was lining up to try to get a triple, that first one came down and smoked me clean in the dome, knocked me smack out, broke the GoPro off my head. Probably the funniest thing about it too is that my friends did not even realize what had happened. I had my buddy Chase on my left and my buddy Brian on my right, and both of them looked down after they had finished shooting and went, "What's wrong with you? Why are you on the ground?" And then they saw the goose laying next to me, and then they saw the GoPro laying on the ground, and then they put it together there in about, you know, 5-10 seconds. And I was out for probably about 5 seconds and started to come to. And I think the first thing I said was, "I have a concussion." And so that was actually pretty early on in the morning. I hunted the rest of the morning with a pretty decent concussion and had to take some ibuprofen when we got back to the truck, but it was certainly worth it in the end. But probably the craziest thing that's ever happened to me on a duck hunt was, not the craziest thing that's happened while I wasn't actually hunting, you know, just when I was going to the spot. I was paddling in my first year ever, and I think maybe my second or third river paddle. I used to hunt the spot where I would paddle up river like 2 miles against this pretty strong river and hunt a swamp or beaver pond up at the top of the river. And I was paddling in the dark, had my headlamp turned off, and just and this river's not very big, 10 to 15 yards wide throughout most of it. And I just heard this crunch, this weird crunching noise. And I turned my headlight on, and there was an entire pack of coyotes standing right there beside the river. I mean, within almost paddle's reach of me. And I think what they must have heard is me paddling up the river, and they must have thought I was a deer crossing the river, and they were going to try to ambush that deer when it got to the other bank. And so, yeah, turned my headlight on to a whole pack of coyotes right there. And so that one made me jump pretty good and made me a little unnervy paddling that river for the rest of the season. But I also, you know, I'm really thankful that was how I got into kind of exploring new areas. I was always doing it alone. So, you know, to this day, I don't really have any issues with walking in the dark on by myself. And, you know, I think that's probably something that a lot of waterfowl hunters don't want to talk about. But I think from at least from the amount from the guys I've hunted with, my limited sample size, it seems like that's maybe a little bit of an unspoken fear among some people, is walking in the dark in unfamiliar woods or paddling in by yourself.
Yeah, it's never stopped me from doing it, but I can definitely say it's not my favorite thing to do. It's just it's funny how humans have that natural fear of things that they can't see, and especially in places where you're familiar with and you know what's there, but you can't see it beyond your headlamp. So it always makes me think, for sure.
Yeah, the fear of the unknown, and at least my mind has a funny way of playing tricks on me when I'm walking in the woods alone. You know, I'll see shapes on tree. You know, I'll see a face in a tree or something like that. It's like, it certainly, I think that fight or flight drive is kicked in big time when you're doing those solo explorations.
That's for sure. So did you get that goose on camera? Did it hit? Could you see it on the film, on the video, hitting the GoPro?
Yeah, That clip was maybe the reason that I kind of started to have some success with YouTube and stuff like that. That clip went pretty viral, actually, funny enough. And so some of my buddies still to this day call me Goose Face, kind of as a passing joke. And so, yeah, it was a pretty funny clip. Still to this day is one that whenever I see it pop up, because it'll kind of just pop up randomly on social media, you know, someone will steal it and post it on their own account, and it always just gives me a good little chuckle, like, did that really happen? It was funny because most of the people I went to college with didn't waterfowl hunt, never hunted. They had no idea about anything to do with guns. And so I was kind of the outlier. And so when that happened, everybody was always asking me about it. And the question everybody would always ask me, especially girls, would always ask me if it hurt. And it was like, that was a tough one for me to wrap my mind around. Because I'd always tell them, I was like, I mean, this is a 10 to 12 pound bird falling from 30 or 40 yards with already has forward momentum. I mean, imagine if someone took a bowling ball and threw it off a three-story roof and hit you in the head. Yeah, it's going to hurt a little bit.
Oh, man. Is that on the Hoke Outdoors or is that on the older channel?
Yeah, that's on Hoke Outdoors. Actually, just this summer, I posted a short of it. So okay. If you just want to see that clip and you don't want to watch the whole video, just go check out that short.
Somehow I missed it. I'll have to go back and look for it.
All right, yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, hopefully, fingers crossed, that's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I'd be completely fine if I never get hit in the head by a goose again.
So what's next for you in your channel? What do you got planned coming up this year?
Oh man, I always have a pretty fluid schedule. That's one of the biggest blessings getting to work for Corey up here, is that Corey hunts, you know, he's just as passionate, if not more, about waterfowl hunting than I am. And so he gives me a lot of leeway to go and chase birds whenever the conditions get right. So I typically keep it really fluid. I know the last couple of weeks I've been planning a trip out to South Dakota with some of my buddies from Virginia. So I'm really looking forward to getting them out to the Midwest this year. But beyond that, I mean, that's about all I have planned so far. I think, like I said, hopefully Alaska probably for a week or two in September. And then beyond that, kind of just go where the wind takes me. I got a year and a half old black lab now. Corey has a red lab named Rue, and she's just the most incredible dog I've ever hunted with. And so after hunting with her for a couple seasons, I knew I wanted to get a puppy out of her. And so she had a litter of pups a couple years back, and I was able to get one of those. So he's a year and a half old. I mainly just hunted him for pheasants last year, and so this year will be kind of my first year really getting him into waterfowl hunting, and so I'm really looking forward to that. I think that'll probably be my biggest either success or failure this year probably will be whether or not I can turn him into a duck dog.
Yeah, I think it'll turn out well. It seems like you're a pretty motivated young man, and everything that you've done to this point has been successful. So I wish you the best of luck, but I'm pretty sure you'll be all right.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm hoping so. I'd say I've realized that I'm not the world's not the world's best dog trainer. I think I'm probably too analytical of a person in that, you know, I'm really numbers and statistics oriented. And so the whole being able to read a dog and figure out what I need to change in my training program, that's always been a struggle for me. But it's been fun. It's been interesting. And I'm hoping it'll all turn out for the best.
Yeah. Did you have any trouble with the new non-resident South Dakota licensing issues?
No, I got super lucky. I drew last year, my first time ever putting in, and then this year, the odds go up if you're in a group. So, this year we got a group of six of us together, and I felt pretty confident that we were going to draw, and thankfully we did. So it's not too much of an issue, you know. I'd say you're probably going to get it about 3 out of every 4 years is what it looks like from the draw odd statistics. So fingers crossed, you know, nobody else go to South Dakota. The hunting there is horrible. There's no pheasants. There's no ducks. There's no geese. Hopefully those draw statistics will stay the exact same for a few years.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got some rapid fire questions for you before we wrap up, if you're game for it.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, what's your favorite waterfowl?
Ooh, I think Drake Widgeon. Widgeon have just always captivated me.
Nice.
For some reason, I mean, right when I got into waterfowl hunting, I knew I wanted to kill, wanted to be able to harvest my first ever widgeon, and I was able to do that in Virginia, actually on public land in Virginia. So that was a really, really special bird for me. And then I've been really blessed over the last couple of years to be able to experience some incredible widgeon hunting in Texas and Oklahoma. And so they've really become a favorite bird of mine. You know, they decoy readily. They're just a lot of fun. And I think really the reason that they're my favorite is that I just think the drakes are the most beautiful duck there is. Just that green iridescence in the head, the white wing patches, the tertiary feathers. I hope I'm saying that right. Just so many beautiful feathers on them. And they've just always captivated me because of that.
Yeah, I just recently watched that video in Texas where that big group come out of the field and that whole flock landed on that little pond there. That was pretty awesome. I definitely want to get down there and experience that sometime.
Yeah, that was a fun one. I mean, I think that was probably an anomaly for that part of the world. You know, I think the part of Texas we were in, you might see those widgeon concentrations once every 10 years. That was right after that big January cold front that locked up all of Kansas and Oklahoma. So I know the guys you know, the locals down there that I talked to, they said they hadn't seen widgeon around like that in quite a few years. But, we were just really lucky and got there at the right time.
That was incredible. What's your favorite waterfowl recipe?
Oh, probably skin on, cast iron seared duck breast. There's nothing better to me than a fat January wood duck, putting it on the cast iron for lunch the same morning when you got it that same morning, just a little bit of salt on it, on the breast, on the skin, cook that skin down real slow, probably 20, 25 minutes skin side down on real low heat to get that skin really nice and crispy, and then just finish it off on the skinless side. And right there, you know, I like my duck pretty rare. So right there between rare and medium rare is how I like it.
Sounds good. What's your favorite shotgun?
I'm partial to the Franke Affinity. I've been using that gun for 5 years now, so I like it a lot. It fits me so well. I think probably the best waterfowl hunting gun ever, though, would be the Remington 870. I've shot those a few times, and, I mean, there's nothing as reliable as an old Remington 870. So if you're looking for your first ever waterfowl hunting gun, go on a little pawn shop tour and try to find you a good condition 870.
Can't go wrong with that, for sure. What's your favorite snack in the blind?
Oh, that's a tough one. Probably chocolate-covered pretzels. I am an absolute sucker for those. I make a bag of those disappear real quick. Yeah, Dr. Pepper and some chocolate-covered pretzels would probably be my favorite, you know, gas station snack. But Corey has an incredible goose jerky recipe. So that's been kind of my go-to over the last couple of years, trying to keep it a little healthier in the duck blind.
All things being equal, do you prefer to hunt lakes, swamps, or rivers?
Oh, a swamp for sure, yeah. I think just growing up in Virginia, cutting my teeth in the places I did, a swamp will always hold a really, really special place in my heart. I'd say probably particularly a beaver pond. A beaver pond off the beaten path that, you know, it came down a little bit during the summer, got some really good aquatic vegetation or moist soil plants growing around the edges. I think that's got to be my favorite. That's kind of the perfect recipe to get some black ducks, some mallards, and some wood ducks in a Virginia swamp.
Very cool. How many decoys do you use on an average hunt?
Probably right about a dozen and a half, two dozen. I'm not a big spread guy. I've tried it more and more the last couple of years just because I've had access to more decoys. And, you know, you see these spreads of guys running 8, 9, 10 dozen decoys in other parts of the country. And so I've wanted to try it more the last few years just to see if it works. But I'd say more times than not, you know, I would rather put my effort into scouting and be as close to the X as possible with a smaller spread than try to traffic them with a bigger spread. And I'd say that's partially because I'm still relatively new to calling as well. You know, people like Corey, who have been calling for 15, 20, 25 years, you know, I know he has no problem at all setting it up for a traffic goose hunt. But for me to go out and set up on a traffic goose hunt, I'm going to have that sinking feeling that is my calling really good enough to convince these birds, or are they just going to fly over my head and keep going to the spot they've been going for however many days?
Yeah, that's a good plan. Do you prefer to go by boat, kayak, or walk-in?
Kayak for sure, every single time. Yeah, I think there's just something so much more, I feel so much more connected to the place that I'm hunting when I'm kayaking. For some reason, having a boat with a motor on it, just I don't want to call it cheating, but I'd say that's probably what it feels like to me. It just doesn't feel like you're really putting in the work to get to where the birds want to be. You know, count on a motor to get you there. And so different strokes for different folks, but I would much rather go to a spot that's kayak accessible only or non-motorized and do it that way.
Very cool. Of all the places you've been, what is your favorite place to waterfowl hunt?
I'd say I'm going to give two answers for this one. I'd say the most rewarding place is the East Coast. I mean, there's nothing more rewarding than shooting ducks on public land in Virginia or North Carolina. You know, I can't speak for other states. I'm sure it's probably the same way. But yeah, shooting ducks on the East Coast is just such a rewarding feeling to be able to do that, and just really special to me. So I love being able to go home and do that. But my favorite place I've ever waterfowl hunted would it'd have to be Idaho, probably. Idaho was just really special. I only got to go out there and hunt for 4 days, but it's the combination for me of the scenery and the birds. You know, there was a lot of birds out there, but it wasn't so easy that you could go and shoot birds anywhere. You had to put in your work for them, but you're shooting ducks with mountains as the backdrop, which for me, that just gives me a different emotional feeling than any other sort of hunt.
Yeah, there's something about that. I've had the chance to hunt in Montana with similar landscape, and definitely highly recommend anybody experience that for sure at least once in their life.
Yeah, no doubt at all. Yeah, I mean, I think it might be because some of my first time ever harvesting a duck was on a small little stream in the Shenandoah Valley. So had the Blue Ridge Mountains on one side and the Allegheny Mountains on the other. And so I think that feeling of being able to duck hunt while you're also looking at mountains, I think it kind of brings me back to those earliest waterfowl hunting memories.
Mm-hmm. And feeling like you get that big adventure, like you mentioned too, which we're always seeking.
Yep. No doubt.
Well, Thomas, I appreciate it. I've had you on here for about an hour. Appreciate your time. wanted to give you an opportunity to let everybody know where they can find you and anything else you want to mention before we wrap up.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on. And if you want to check out some waterfowl hunting videos, my YouTube channel is Hoke Outdoors. I got about 7, if not 8 seasons worth of waterfowl hunts on there now. The newer ones are probably a little bit higher quality than the older ones. So take your pick on those. And then I'm only really active on Instagram. So I got a page over there under Hoke Outdoors as well.
All right, sir. Well, I appreciate it. Hang on there for a second once I wrap this up, but can't thank you enough for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brian. Really appreciate you having me on.
Big thanks again to Thomas for taking time out of his day to join me on the show. And thank you all so much for tuning in. I really appreciate it. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Migration Waterfowl. We also have a Facebook group for the podcast. Please join us there as well. And if you could, please check out our YouTube channel and subscribe while you're there. Lots of great content coming that way throughout the rest of the year. Don't forget to join us every Monday for a bonus Migration Monday video podcast. You can find links to our merchandise store on our Facebook and Instagram pages. Check out our shirts, hoodies, thermoses, coffee, and more over there. And now through the end of September, 10% of everything we sell will go to Ducks Unlimited. If you like what you've heard here, please take a moment and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to send me a message or email after you leave the review, and I will mail you a podcast decal. And get out there and enjoy the outdoors, but make sure you seek out a relationship with the one who created everything. Titus chapter 2, verses 11 through 14 says, "For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people. It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age, while we wait for the blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good." And remember, the migration is coming. Be ready when it arrives. Tune in next week to hear another great guest on the Migration Waterfowl Podcast.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.